Okay, we are just rolling on to 4:30 my time. So I got to go ahead and mute all. And as usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. If you do so to make a comment or question, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And if I hear background noise, I will unceremoniously mute those people unless they're presenting. So, yeah, just a reminder, I guess, as we were talking about it, if you haven't reserved yet for the pizza party in June, please do so. So we have a count of how many pizzas to have and drinks and all the rest of it for there. So it looks like, for now at least, if you go to our homepage, scroll to the bottom to upcoming events, and if you filter on regular meetings, monthly meetings, it'll be the one there for June. Otherwise, you have to wade through a bunch of other ones before it. And so, welcome to everybody. And if we have any new people with us tonight, we do welcome guests at any time at the AutoPCs of Good Meetings. If you want to join, it's just $20 a year. And you can go to our homepage and click on the Join or Renew button at the top, and that'll step you through the process. But feel free to continue to join us as a guest for as often as you would like to. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Well, actually, Chris, you have slide control, and the first slide is yours.
Okay, let me click on that. If it's going to work for me, and it's going to work. So, we have, as of tonight, passed 10,000 participants in our Q&A sessions that have been hosted on Zoom, which was when COVID lockdowns happened. And so, congratulations to all. We've been doing this on Zoom for 6 years now, and it's been highly successful, and we continue to have good turnout, thanks to all of you. So, thanks on that. And are you next, Alan?
No, next one's yours, too.
Next one's mine, too. Haven't been following along too well here. Okay, yes, keyboard shortcut number 9. So this is a long-running series that we have on, I just lost Alan's slide. Jeez. Okay, I'll figure that out in a minute. I'll just go to my copy of it and I can get that working. So this is a long-run series on keyboard shortcuts, the idea being that you stay away from removing your hands from the keyboard and reaching for the mouse, and to click on things, you just use keyboard shortcut instead. And there, come to the cohort. Okay, so if you want to quickly move the text insertion cursor, so where your keystrokes are actually going to go, by paragraph. So if you want to jump to the start of the next paragraph, it's Control and down arrow. And if you want to jump to the start of the previous paragraph, Control and the up arrow. And that is today's keyboard shortcut.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Okay, so now we have a series of questions that came in as part of the user survey. And the first one was, how do I recover files if they have been accidentally deleted? So a number of ways to do that. The simplest is, if you're on Windows, is just restore it from the recycle bin, because that's typically where it will be. So you just go to the recycle bin, find your file, and you can restore the selected item, or you have an option to restore all of the items if you want to get everything that's there. Another way to do it, if you're like me and make regular, very frequent backups to a USB drive, I can just simply restore it from my USB drive that has an up-to-date copy of all my active data files. I just bring it back from the backup drive. And Chris says that he can do it by Chris.
Okay, dropping this over to me. Okay, yeah. If you use something like EaseUS to do backup or any imaging software, besides the ability to actually do a complete restore where you're restoring entire partitions or drives or every drive on your computer, they all will allow you to go into the backup set and recover individual files, as you see on here. So the tab is on file mode for doing the recovery, and then you just drill down. One thing I'll caution on using that is, by default, I find that when you go into file mode, it's selected every partition, every drive, every folder, every file. And so you have to basically deselect them all at the top level and then drill down to the one file or folder that you want and then just select those items, and then you can do the restore. And
yeah, the next slide yours too.
Yeah, if I can click on it, there we go. Okay. Is this mine or did I jump forward too?
No, that's it.
Okay. So file history. I use file history, which is built into Windows. And it's a little bit lobotomized in Windows 11, but it's still workable. There's some workarounds for the deficiencies, and I've talked about this in my wool backup presentation. So if you do have file history turned on, you can go into File Explorer, and then you can basically right-click on any file, and under the properties, you'll have a tab in the properties dialog box called Previous Versions, and you can restore any of those. And if you have deleted a file, you have nothing to right-click on. So what you do is you go to the ribbon, and you say File History, and it brings up the VCR Tech Control where you can browse through your backup files that were done with file history, find the one you want, and restore that particular file. Apparently, there is a program in the Microsoft Store called Windows File Recovery, which I've never actually used myself. So you could check that out. And then there are some third-party utilities that will allow you to recover files. And these are ones that everything else has failed, and so you end up doing this. What it will do is it'll really sniff out any files that have been marked as deleted files, and it will try to recover the files with varying degrees of success. So the less that goes on the disk between when you decide that you actually deleted a file and you want to recover it, the better, to make sure that there's a maximum chance that the file space has not been reused for a different file. So a couple of files there are programs you can download that will allow you to do that sort of recovery.
Will it work on an SSD, though, or is it just a mechanical drive?
No. It's doing things at a logical level, so it doesn't matter whether it's an SSD or a spinning hard drive.
Yeah, it's basically the operating system is marking the space as available, but may not have used it yet.
Yeah. In the old FAT system, the way that they did it was that they just renamed the file, and the first character was a character that was illegal in normal use, and that marked the file as being deleted. And then all of the file allocation table entries for that file, one chunk to another, were all marked as available. And so there is a chain that is actually maintained one to the next. But the ability to recover it using this, it really is a last-ditch attempt at a very important file. You can try that, and you may or may not be successful at it. That's it for the other options.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. So moving on to the next question. It was all about cleaning up the computer and basically managing files. So actually, I think this is yours too, Chris, this disk cleanup stuff.
Okay, hang on. Let me just paste this into the chat. So we have the URLs there. Disk cleanup, it's an older tool that has been available in Windows for a long time, and it still has some charm that is not available in some of the other disk cleanup capabilities that are built into Windows. So I do point to one of the Q&As where I did talk about using disk cleanup. One of the biggest things that it's useful for is cleaning up Windows Update cleanup. So the way Windows Update works is that typically Patch Tuesday, second Tuesday of the month, a whole bunch of files get replaced in Windows. And in order for you to be able to roll back changes, if for some reason your computer doesn't really work all that well after an update has been applied, you can roll back that update. Well, how does it work? It has the old copies of all of those files on your disk. Eventually, Windows Update is supposed to do cleanup of those older files. It does so to a varying degree of success. I have seen some computers where, you know, anything that is more than a month or two old, you couldn't recover anyways, and I think it's because it's doing an automatic cleanup. However, I have seen computers that have 11 gigabytes of files that were allocated to these older versions of files when Windows Update operates. And so they're just sitting there, and unless you try to roll back anything, it's just wasting space. Usually the way that I go about doing it is that about a week or two after Patch Tuesday, if my computer is working fine, I'm not going to want to roll back any of those updates. So I will then go into disk cleanup, let it do its magic to clean up any of those files. And then there was another thing on using other tools for doing disk cleanup, and that was covered off in a Q&A as well. So there's some other options there that you can take a look at. And that's it for that.
Okay, so the next question was, what's the best way to transfer files, including data and programs, to a new computer? And again, we've covered that a couple of times previously. Trying to change the slide here. There we go. And there's an Ask Leo video which basically tells you how to do that. In the Q&A sessions at one point, last year basically, there were a number of utilities, easiest to do PC Trans, a program called FastMove, and PC Mover from Laplink, were all available to do this kind of transferring files from an old computer to a new one. So if whoever it is wants to know that, then those are the places to go look for the answers there. next question was about PDF files and how to sign them. And it was pointed out that there are all kinds of ways to do it. And the question was, does anybody have any experience with actually doing it? Personally, I've only ever done it by signing my name on a piece of paper, scanning the signature into an image file, and then pasting that image into the writable PDF file, and basically resizing the image in the block where your signature is supposed to go. But there are some options to do that, and Stuart provided some of those. So Stuart, if you'd like to unmute your microphone and tell us about Genius Sign to start with.
Genius Sign is great. It's for idiots. It's that good. I recently acquired a new landlord and had to find a new way to pay my rent, and he sent me this app saying, here you go. And unfortunately, it only works on iOS, so all you Android and Windows users can't use this one. But it's very simple to import a PDF that you've scanned or received. And the nice thing is you can actually use your finger on the touch screen and write your signature as if you had a pen, or use a pen that works with the device to get an actual signature. And that's the free version. Being really cheap, of course, I'm not going to pay for the classy one that probably professional or commercial users will want to use, that can be a lot more secure and fancy and good for people on the space station or whatever. I don't know what it's for. But it works only on iOS. However, there is something else. From the before I had an Apple computer, Apple phone, I've used this website called, help me out with the pronunciation here, Sejda. Anyway, this website, whatever the heck it is, there's all kinds of neat tricks for your PDFs. The one we're talking about is signing it. So you go on their website, and thank you, Alan. There's a little icon there that says PDF sign. Click there. It lets you upload a PDF. And similarly, there's different ways of doing it. You can just type in your name, and it will do a generic fake. What's that phrase for handwriting that isn't printing? I'm having a senior's moment here.
Well, they're using handwriting fonts, right?
Okay, handwriting. There's a handwriting font. It looks terrible, but it's legible. Calligraphy. The nice thing is you can actually read your signature, whereas, you know, if I actually do my signature, I can't read it, so we never really know who signed what. And this works as a website in the cloud, so anybody in any device that can access the cloud can use this. And there are some other options that I never played with, such as drawing your signature somewhere and uploading it and getting all fancy and complicated, which I'm not, so I never explored that, but it's a great website for quickly signing and downloading a PDF and sending it off to whoever's demanding your signature on a document. It can do a lot of other things that I never explored, but if people are heavily into PDFs and office work, I suggest you take a look at it.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. I can't imagine signing my name with a mouse, but...
Yeah, that sucks.
And they will let you do that.
I did try that. It really sucks.
Okay, next up we have a question about... the question was, what was the one thing you'd like to know more about relating to computers? And the question came in, 3D printers. Now, unfortunately, neither Chris nor I have a 3D printer, and I don't know anything about 3D printers. I don't know enough to talk seriously about it. So if anybody has a 3D printer or has used a 3D printer and would like to talk about 3D printers, we'd love to hear from you. So suggestion box at opcug.ca. And we'll sign you up for a mini presentation on 3D printers. Okay, Chris has got some slides now on DNS.
Yeah, so there's specifically a service called NextDNS, which I was sort of intrigued. A couple of techies that I follow on various forums and that were using NextDNS and thought it was wonderful, so I decided I should check it out. So just a little bit of a step backwards, DNS, domain name service. So it's described as the phone book of the Internet. So it's how computers find each other on the Internet rather than using IP addresses. So as an example, your computer doesn't connect to cdc.ca. It connects to an IP address. So how does it get that IP address? And it does it automatically, but humans can actually use a program called NSLookup to find an IP address. And so here I ran it. It's a command line app, so you just run CMD or command prompt, and then you type in NSLookup and the name that you want to look up. So in this case, I did NSLookup cdc.ca, and you can see that it actually did return an IP address for cdc.ca. And so your computer then can go to that when it does the lookup on your behalf. So that it just basically is the standard on DNS is that it just returns the IP address, period, blank, whatever it is. But what if it could actually do a little bit more? So this comes down to DNS-based security. So what if rather than just blindly returning the IP address for a given domain name, what if it could try to determine whether the site is actually safe or it's malicious or in a category you don't want to visit or whatever? So rather than using the DNS server that your internet service provider gives to you, you can point to a replacement DNS server, and there's a number of them out there. And then what happens is when it looks up the IP address, it also tries to determine whether this is a safe or unsafe address to go to. And if it thinks that it's safe, it'll just return the IP address. If it thinks that it's unsafe, it'll actually give you an IP address of a server that actually will just come up and say the site is blocked or it's unsafe or whatever they want to actually tell you. So some of the examples that you can get, Sierra has Canadian Shield, and it can block access to, it has a couple of levels. So one of them is just security. One of them will actually block access to anything it determines as being malware, phishing, botnet, or scams. Or you can go to one that does all of that, plus blocking sexual content. Quad 9 is one of the bigger ones out there. It was started by IBM Security. It is now a consortium of about a dozen security companies, and they have terabytes and terabytes of information about malicious sites. And so it will block access to a really wide range of threats, but it really is threats rather than anything else. So malware, phishing, spyware, botnets, things like that. So it'll block you from getting to those. OpenDNS Home works very much the same as Quad 9. OpenDNS Family Shield actually allows you to block in categories. So you can actually go in, you have to create an account, and a little bit more setup for it. But once you do that setup, you could, say, block access to social media sites or comedy sites. I don't know what their blocking categories are. But there's over 50 categories that you could actually decide to block in addition to security-related issues. So what do they block? So I'm sure that they actually do block access to known malicious sites, known to them as being malicious. But do they do some other things for you? Like maybe block sites behaving suspiciously, whatever that means. Use AI. Of course, everything needs to use AI nowadays. So to identify new threats. Prevent your computer from being used in cryptojacking, where your computer's CPU will actually be trying to mine cryptocurrency. Block access to domains that are disguising themselves, for example, using Latin letter E and replace that with Cyrillic letter E, which looks identical in most typefaces. And so you think you're going to one place and you're actually going to somewhere else. Take advantage of typos. You know, Google with three O's instead of two O's. Block new sites. This is an interesting one. Google actually says that the average malicious site on the internet exists for less than 10 minutes before they give up on it and they move on to something new. I find that a little bit hard to believe, but Google says so, so it must be true.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could block access to specific top-level domains. If you do not want to have any access to sites in Kazakhstan or China or whatever, you could actually block access to those or block trackers and ads. So do these other sites that are doing this DNS-based security do all these extra things? Well, NextDNS does. Can do that and more. Now, before I go on, I will say that this is maybe I should have been using my deep dive icon here on the slide, because this is something that maybe more advanced users are going to be interested in rather than new people, and I'll come back to why later on. It's not that hard to use, but experienced users are probably going to be more attracted to it. So nextdns.io is the site, and their strap line is the new firewall for the modern internet and protecting you from security threats, blocking ads, trackers, all kinds of things. They're going to do that for you. It sounds very impressive. And in actual fact, it is pretty impressive. Is it for everyone? Maybe not, and I'll come back to why it's not maybe the best solution for everybody. So you go there, and you go under the Setup tab, and you create a free account, and it will give you under that free account 300,000 DNS queries per month. Okay, unlimited devices that log in using that account. Of course, you can have multiple accounts, so you can have 300,000 DNS queries per month. Sounds like an awful lot. I ran out by about two-thirds of the way through the month. And I think most people may have similar sort of thing. It's surprising the number of DNS queries that get done from your computer. You get unlimited configurations, so you can set up multiple configurations, switch between them, and so forth. There is a pro plan where you start paying for it. So basically, talking $20 a year, and that'll give you unlimited queries, devices, configurations. So if you try it and you really like it, you may quickly find that you will run out of the DNS queries, and you would have to pay in order to get that extra one or the extra queries for that one. So it does link to your IP address and to save the settings. So all the configuration is done by going to their website, and you log in, you make changes to the configuration. And it can deal with your IP address changing over time. There's a little app that can track that. If your IP address changes, it can update it automatically at the next DNS website. So the security tab has 13 different categories of potential threats that you can choose from. Any or all of them can be turned on. And you can see here there's a wide, wide range where I talked about, can your security-based DNS do the following? Here they all are, and a whole bunch of extras as well. On the privacy tab, there's 83 different third-party blocking lists. So these are ones that other people have come up with that they say these are bad sites for one reason or another, and you can use any or all of them. The first one is on the list is NetDNS ads and trackers block list. And they say it's comprehensive block list, block ads, trackers in all countries. And they actually say this is recommended starter block list. So when I did this snapshot of it, there was over 80,000 entries in it, and it was updated 2 days prior, so it is kept up to date. But remember that name. We'll come back to that. One host, there's just a couple of the other ones that are on there that sort of popped out as being interesting. Safeguard your devices against pesky ads, trackers, malware, and this had almost 1 million entries, and it was updated 18 hours ago. So again, actively maintained. Easy list Hebrew. So this is just one of the curious ones. Removes adverts on Hebrew language websites. And it had a grand total of 136 entries, and it was updated 3 days ago. So they're keeping it up to date, if that's what you want. If you want no Facebook or no Google, you can actually do block lists that will block you from every known IP address that is used by Facebook or for Google. And they're, you know, while the no Facebook was only updated a year ago, maybe that's because Facebook isn't adding an awful lot of new services. I don't know. No Google was updated 20 days previous. Again, those are ones that are not likely to be updated really, really frequently. Or you get down to things like Energized Spark. Zero entries, updated a month ago. So not terribly useful. So if you're using any of these 83 different third-party block lists, take a close look at the description and how many entries and how frequently it is updated before you choose them. And click. There we go. On the privacy tab, continue. So native tracking protection. This is kind of an interesting one. They call it block wide spectrum trackers. And this is something where it's really down at the operating system level that things are happening that can track your activity on the device. I don't understand this, quite frankly, but they have separate things there so they can actually track these wide spectrum trackers, whatever they really are, for Windows, Apple, Samsung, you know, right down to Roku devices and Sonos speakers. So it's in beta. I don't know what it does, but it's there. Parental controls, you can actually restrict access to specific websites, apps, games, things like that. They have different categories that you can choose. And, come on. It catches up with me. You can specify recreation time, which would be as a parent, and you want to allow your kids to actually go to any of these sites at particular times. They'll be blocked at other times. You can put on a safe search, where it looks for explicit results in major search engines. And note on there, they will block access to search engines not supporting this feature. So I don't know how you would tell whether safe search is actually enabled at your particular search engine or not. And then they have YouTube restricted mode, and filtering out mature content. And it'll hide comments for whatever benefit that has. And then they have a thing here, they say block bypass methods. So if there are things that are trying to block access or block the blocking through DNS filtering, you can do that, but it will prevent access of VPNs and things like that. So they do have some cautions throughout it, which is a little bit of whether you really want to do it or not. They have a section where you can override all the other rules and either block something or allow it. So I have here on my allow list star.microsoft.com. So why would I whitelist star.microsoft.com. Does that mean that a whole bunch of stuff at microsoft.com is going to be considered malicious? Stay tuned. Analytics on here is really actually fascinating to look at. So it gives you all your queries, the block queries, the percentage block, top six resolved in block domains, GAFAM, which is the first time I came across this term. So it's Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, or Microsoft. And it's amazing what percentage of people's browsing or use on their computer actually is to one of the top five on them. Gives you a map of the world showing where your queries are landing and counts. A few other things. That's quite fascinating to actually look at. In the logs tab, it will actually log every DNS query, whether it was allowed or blocked, and it'll give you a reason why it was blocked if that was the case. So, sounds like everything is really wonderful. Well, maybe not so much. Problem is, anytime you allow someone else to block access to something, mistakes can happen. Okay? That's basically a given. The more you protect yourself, the more likely it is you're going to block access to something you actually wanted access to. So this is the two-edged sword of security. And I thought I was pretty good at determining things like that. And then, Microsoft Quick Assist, which is a utility that helps you connect to a remote computer, and you can see the person's screen and optionally get control of the keyboard and mouse. And the OPC-UG 1-on-1 remote assistance uses it. Very useful. I went to use Quick Assist with Linda so that I could see something that was on her computer. And then she got a pop-up saying, session ended. And it said, we ended the connection because the minimum security requirements on the helper side were not met. No need to report this. We're on it. So, what they really should have said is, we blocked the connection because the helper was not able to access part of Microsoft's infrastructure. But they didn't say that. So I could have just believed the dialog box and said, oh, okay, no need to report, we're on it. And, okay, I can't help you out today, Linda. We'll do it tomorrow. But it turns out that I certainly thought about it a little bit, and come on, accept my click. And it accepted 2 clicks. So I recalled that I had just started using NextDNS, and I thought, I wonder what the logs have to say about that. Right at the time that Linda got that pop-up, I actually was blocked from getting to vlscppe.microsoft.com. And the reason for the block was NextDNS ads and trackers, that should be trackers, block list. What does this have to do with ads and trackers? Nothing. So I didn't want to turn off the entire feature of that entire ads and trackers block list, but they obviously had an error in there as far as I'm concerned. So I decided that I would just add star.microsoft.com to the allow list, so we just ignore that. I'm basically just going to say I'm going to trust Microsoft. All of their websites are not malicious, which, who knows, might be foolish on my part, but we'll go with it. And then as soon as I did add that to the whitelist, then Quick Assist worked normally. So this is an example of where things can actually come back to bite you when you allow somebody else to do things on your behalf security-wise. I looked around in the log files, and I also saw that there was a block here of upload2.fp.measure.office.com. Should I be worried about that? I don't know. I don't know what that particular URL is used for. It may actually block some important functionality that is in some of my Office apps. I don't know. The thing that it actually perplexity said about that particular subdomain was primarily used for performance measurement and telemetry. Probably not a concern of mine, but who knows? I don't know for certain. So, probably not a problem, but do I want to go through that log file, 300,000 queries a month, folks, and see, and I can filter it down to just say, just show me the ones that are blocked, but do I want to go through that list and try to figure out if any of those blocked ones I actually wanted to have happen, and, you know, it didn't work for me. So it appears to be a really, really good powerful tool for blocking ads, trackers, malicious sites, all kinds of security-related stuff. It can be very aggressive, and almost certainly, I think, it could block legitimate sites and services you count on. And it, even the settings that, you know, the main reason why you chose NetDNS can come back to bite you like that one of using Microsoft Quick Assist. So you can work around absolutely every problem because they log everything and the explanations are pretty clear when you go and you find them. I don't think it has the raw blocking capability of some of the tools like Quad9, Canadian Shield, or OpenDNS, but I actually prefer, I think, for myself to use Quad9 or Canadian Shield. Both of them are very reliable. So I say, will I be using this? You know, when I did these slides up, which goes back a few weeks, I would say for now, yes. In actual fact, I have stopped using it. So very powerful utility. Some people really think it's cat's meow. And depending on how much you're willing to put up with possible false positives and things like that, check it out. And you may find it useful. And that's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. There's a question here from for DNS queries. Once you set it up, is it automatic for sites visited, or do you engage it for specific sites?
It's for everything. All your DNS queries are going to go through it.
It's one time set up, and then it just runs automatically in the background.
Exactly. And you can go in on the site, and you can see how many queries you've used that month, right up to date. And so you can actually see if you're approaching the 300,000, things like that. The site is actually very, very well designed. It's just that when it blocks stuff, I think it might be a little bit too aggressive for the average user. And while it might protect you and give you a really good degree of protection, you got to be willing to realize that if something is blocked, you're not getting to something that you think you should be able to get to. You may have to check it out in NextDNS to see if it's something in there that actually blocks you, and then whitelist it, or what, turn off that particular feature, or, you know, react to it somehow. So you're going to have to deal with it.
And Tom has a suggestion for a different product called OpenDNS, which he says is free with lots of features, which includes logging and banning particular domains. So I guess that would be, I don't know whether that's free OpenDNS, whether that has unlimited DNS queries. Maybe it does.
No, there's no limit, and I think I made a presentation on this, so you can probably search the OPCUG website for it.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, just one final thing on it. I think if people are looking for a little bit of added protection, I certainly think the Quad9 and Canadian Shield from Sierra, both of those are very reliable. They don't seem to be blocking things that they shouldn't be blocking. And it is a good level of added security on your computer. NextDNS, I think people have to be willing to, you know, struggle a little bit with it at least.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. So next up, we have the final part in my mini-series on image backup and recovery. And so far, we've talked about making full disk images and recovering them, and the need to make a bootable rescue disk sometimes if you want to recover the operating system, for example. And we talked about file and folder recovery from disk images. And now I want to talk about disk image testing, because you don't really make backup images just so that you can store them. It would be nice if when you needed it, when you actually needed to recover an image, you could actually do that. And what you really need to do is test the image to, A, make sure that you can access the image, and B, make sure that you can actually access the files and folders on that image. So really, you don't want to wait until the disk fails and now you're in big trouble and you need to be able to recover the image. So you want to make sure you can access it now. So As I say, there's no problem. You've got a perfectly good hard drive right now running Windows and all your applications. Just blow all that stuff away, reformat your hard drive so it's pristine and new, and then recover the disk image, and you'll find out whether it works or not. Maybe you don't want to do that. I actually have done that several times, and it works perfectly every time. But there's a much better way, and the better way is to, first of all, verify the image. So you can use, in ESUS, you can use the Tools menu, and then go to Check Image, and it will confirm that it can see the image, and it will confirm that the image isn't corrupt. And you can mount the image using Tools and then mount the backup. And what that does is it mounts the image as a virtual disk so that you can see the individual partitions. And again, you can look at the files and folders there. But probably the best way is to actually restore the image to an external USB drive. So if you've got a spare drive that isn't doing anything very much, plug it into the computer, and it needs to be at least as big as the original source drive, the one that you made the backup image from. Clearly, you're going to restore the backup. You have to have a drive big enough to restore it. And you can use Windows Disk Management Utility to blank the USB drive. That will give you a whole bunch of unallocated space. So that's where you're going to recover the image to. And then we're going to use the USB as a target when we go for a recovery operation. And then once we've done that, we can look at the actual files and folders that we recovered in Windows, in a dedicated data drive in my case. Actually, the files and folders will now be reproduced on the external USB drive. So now you've got the best of all worlds. You've made your image and you've recovered your image, and you know that you can access both the image and the files and folders. So basically, what we're going to do is go into ESUS, and we're going to tell it that we want to recover a disk image that we've made. And here's that setup where you choose whether you want to recover a disk or a partition, or as Chris was saying earlier in this session, where you would go to file mode in order to recover an individual file, for example. But we want to recover the whole thing, the whole image. So we're going to stick with this disk image thing here. And we're going to recover it too, but instead of taking the default, which would be we made a backup of my hard drive, now it's going to try and recover it to my hard drive, right? This hard disk zero up here would be the normal place you would recover to. Well, instead of doing that, use the scroll bar here and scroll down until you find something else. And the thing I'm looking for is this guy down here, which is a 1 terabyte USB external drive with a whole bunch of unallocated space. It's got 900 and some gigabytes of space free and waiting to be imaged. So we're going to choose that one, and we're going to check that guy, and we're going to use him as the recovery target drive. So the next thing that ESUS will tell us is, this is what the image looked like on your the disk image, and this is what's going to happen to the external USB drive. And you notice here that by default it says auto fit to disk. And what it's done is it's basically done a 1-for-1 copy until it got to the C drive here, which had 140 gigabytes of space involved. And it decided to blow that up to use all of the available unallocated space that wasn't being used for any other partitions. So it was going to create me a Windows partition of 760 gigabytes on the external drive. Well, that's not a big deal, but I really don't want to do that. So let's go to this drop-down menu here, and instead of auto-fit, let's choose copy as the source. So now it's going to take my 139 gig Windows drive and create a 139 gig Windows drive on the external USB drive. So now I think we're happy. We can tell it to go ahead. And it says, yes, it's done the recovery. It took it almost 2 hours. I have a very slow external USB drive, clearly. And normally it doesn't take me that long. Anyway, there we are. I've got my drive. So here's what the system looks like before we actually plug the USB drive in, I think. And then when I plug the USB drive in, you notice that my Western Digital passport suddenly shows up here, and I get some other things. I get a diagnostics drive, which is Windows has decided is going to be drive A. I've got a Windows drive, which Windows has decided it has to be drive B, which are interesting. A and B, if you remember in the good old days, they were floppy disk drives. Now, because we're not using floppy disk drives anymore, it doesn't mean to say that we can't use A and B, and clearly you can, and the recovery system has decided to do that. So I've got my Windows drive here. I've also got this data drive called drive F, which is my dedicated data disk. So if I now go to disk management, here is my real hard drive, and this is a USB flash drive, 64 gig flash drive. But here is the external 1 terabyte external USB drive. And you can see that we've got a bunch of system partitions. There is that Windows 139 gig drive, which is B. Here's my data disk, which is 16 gig NTFS, dedicated data drive. Some more system partitions. And this guy over here, 62 gig healthy primary partition, is actually my Linux partition, which, of course, Windows refuses to tell me what it is. And I've still got 700 gig of unallocated space on my 1 terabyte external USB. So it's basically, it's recovered the original full disk image. I've got all the partitions from my original hard drive now on my external USB. So I can go and look, I think, at my, yes, this is now looking at my PC. I'm looking at the Windows B drive. So this is the Windows drive which is on the external USB. And you probably notice there that we've got program files down here. We've got program files x86 and a whole bunch of other things which are clearly on the Windows C drive in the real world. This is the data disk F, which is my copy of my dedicated data drive. And sure enough, that's got the files that I expect to see on that one. And I can actually check. I mean, I can. This is now is a real drive, so I can actually go down to this Python script file here, and I can edit it with Notepad++, and I can see the actual Python code inside that script file. So I've recovered the disk image onto an external USB. I've got all of the partitions, and I've got all of the files and folders, and I've actually looked at one of the files and made sure that it's actually correct. So that's basically how I would suggest that you can very easily, relatively easily anyway, check your disk image. Make sure that you can access it when you're going to need to, and then temporarily recover the files to this external USB, take a look at them, and then you can be pretty well guaranteed that when you do need to recover a full disk image, then you'll be able to do that. And that's all I have for disk backup, image, and restore.
There are a couple of questions. Tom asks, does the verify use checksums to check the files?
That I do not know, Tom. I have to check.
I believe it doesn't. What the verify is doing is just looking at the integrity of the backup file to make sure that it can read all of the data, but it doesn't validate that the actual data is correct. It just validates that it's readable information. And he also asks, do you have to choose GPT or MDR for your partitioning? Does it make a difference?
It doesn't make a difference. Whatever your disk is, that's what gets made into the disk image. In that particular case, it was a GPT because it had multiple partitions.
So I would guess that it's going to restore it the same way as it came on the original?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it can look at the disk image. It knows what it's doing, so it just restores whatever was there to start with.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and Jen says, when I copy to files over to an external USB, all the folders were there, but the data was in it.
Maybe was not in it.
No, it was not in it. Sorry, was not in it.
Okay.
Well, how did you copy them? Because copy them by default should check that it's a good copy.
Yeah, you think that. But when I went back, when I needed them, they weren't there. And I lost all my data.
Was this just doing file copies, or was it copying out of a recovery partition?
No, just doing file copies, not out of a recovery. I probably should have had a recovery. That would have helped.
Yeah, I don't know why a file copy just through File Explorer or whatever, why it would fail without giving an indication that it would fail.
I must admit, in a long time ago, I was paranoid about that, and I would use disk copy to copy files, and then I used disk compare to actually do a file comparison and make sure that the file. I still actually do that, but now I use things like WMatch and FileSync to make sure that the files are all there and they're all the same. So certainly if you've had that problem in the past, I'd be concerned about that USB drive, that maybe it's not working correctly. If you copy files to it, I would try using Free File Sync and use the content comparison rather than the date timestamp, because that will do a bit-for-bit compare to the files between your original and the external USB.
And I know Alan is a big fan of Free File Sync, and I am too, because if you have a regular sort of backup that you actually want to do, you define it once, and then you just say, do it. And it does a great job. I used it in addition to other methods of backing up my files. I have a number of different file backups that I actually have. Yeah, but Free File Sync has always been a really, really good option for me. And it can keep versions, and you can define whether your versions will be a certain number of them or over a certain period of time, or, there's all kinds of very, very, very flexible in how it does its synchronization of the files. Great, great program. And free, which is really nice.
Okay, so the final thing we have prepared is a Loony link, which Natalie sent just before the meeting started. And this is actually a Canadian website. It's actually an Ottawa website, iSister Technology Mentoring. And this was started by four teachers in 2001. And basically what they do is they provide computer training for people who want to get into the workforce. And so this is for basically women who need assistance to create, as they say, economic independence. So if you have any interest in that, then there is the URL, isisters.org, and lots of information on the website. Okay, so we are in the last 10. If there are other questions or comments or things that you would like to share with the group, now is the time. So put your hand up, type something in the chat, open up your microphone.
Okay, there's one thing. I was late coming on because I was having a problem with Zoom because I can't, when I was accessing the settings, so Zoom would just crash and disappear. I don't know if that's been a problem with anyone here, but I updated to the latest version after uninstalling the previous version, and now everything seems to work. So, my latest success.
We'll be sure to let everybody know who wasn't able to connect tonight because their Zoom crashed on them.
Zoom is weird. I mean, they keep updating things and things change, but I haven't actually had any problems connecting on Zoom, Tom, so that is unusual, I think.
I hope.
Okay, so while everybody's thinking, let's go into the wrap-up slides.
Richard, you got your hand up?
Yes, just that comment on Zoom. I found that a version of Zoom on Linux crashed as soon as I went into settings. I haven't updated that one since, so I haven't checked whether it's since fixed, but it seemed to be specifically a Linux version that was happening on.
I've used the Linux version recently, and it was working fine, Richard.
Yeah.
It could be just a one-off type version or a one-off glitch, who knows.
Yeah, I suspect so, but that had been happening. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, I've got another comment. Recently, I use Firefox browser, and I keep getting this not responding, and it delays for few seconds. No, I'd assumed it was probably because I was using an older machine with a slower processor, but down at our general user group meeting, one of the other fellows was saying, well, their website is being hit by thousands of queries from these AI bots from China, and website itself that's slowing down and not responding. I'm wondering if other people have had similar things happening with their browsers, in different browsers.
Yeah, I actually don't use Firefox very much, but what I have noticed is in Linux, when I do a system update, it very often wants to update Firefox, and that usually creates a problem. And what I've had to do is go to the list of updates and disable or uncheck Firefox, everything else update, which happens relatively quickly, and then try again and let Firefox update as it wants. But it seems to be very slow to provide the update. So that might be the same issue, Richard.
Yeah, so it's from the comment from that other fellow, I gather it might not be a browser problem at all, but a problem with the website being hit by massive amounts of traffic.
Yeah, it could be. We have a question from, I just missed it there. We have a question from Joss about he's using FreeFileSync to copy between his computer and another computer on his local area network, and it takes about a minute to start the sync. Any ideas why? I've used it for other computers, but it was either through an FTP site, which is another thing that FreeFileSync does a marvelous job with, or doing a Microsoft OneDrive, which it also can handle quite well. And I've never noticed any slowdowns myself. And Alan, did you use it copying across computers?
No, only just over FTP, and I've had the same experience. It's been very quick.
Yeah. Anybody else on the call have an experience with slowdowns using FreeFileSync? If so, you could chime in. And Eldon has a question. Does anyone have a reasonable priced Bluetooth or wired speaker they might recommend? I find my laptop just does not have the volume I need. I've actually been using one from Creative that is Bluetooth. It has Bluetooth. It also has you can do it wired as well. And I've been very, very happy with it. Eldon, if you email me directly, I can tell you specifically the model that I actually have. It's quite loud. And I can fill a a good sized room with sound using it. So email me and I'll tell you the one. If anybody else has recommendations for Bluetooth speakers or wired speakers.
Thomas suggested a Logitech powered speaker connected by wire, which even has a mini subwoofer. For Bluetooth, he says he recommends Trivet.
Okay, and Linda will send me information about the speaker she uses, and I'll include that if you email me, Eldon.
I don't know if they still have any in stock, but about a year ago, I bought this little doohickey at it's Staples in Ontario. Mirolong Grow here in Quebec. It's Bluetooth or wired. $12.
Okay.
That's reasonable. And it works. Not high quality, but it's the Staples brand, too. The no-name Staples brand. So
cool.
It may not be high volume, either.
Oh, it's loud. I have to put my hand over the speaker when I turn it on.
Yeah. Natalie is recommending Blue Snowball. She says it's big but great. So lots of choices there.
This is my Tribit speaker, by the way. I put my money where my mouth is.
I got this small one. Doesn't matter.
I think they're about $60 each, I forget.
Yeah, the Logitech one I bought was, I think, about $35 or something like that. Oh, the Creative one I bought, about $35.
This is about $30.
Yeah.
It's a small one.
A comment on the last question and answer, Chris, about your digital legacy?
Yep.
My wife, Lynn, showed me a Facebook post from a lawyer, an estate lawyer, and she was going on and on and on, and people are having a heck of a time. Apple will not release the phone, even with a death certificate, and that's a big deal, according to what she's going on with. Yeah.
Yeah. Your people got to be prepared, because it can be a horror story for sure. And, yeah, companies they're not interested in helping out people, really.
So yeah, you get 10 tries and the phone's locked out, and Apple won't touch it.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I was interested in it. It was just, like, 2 days after. It was, like, on a Friday. We had the question and answer period on a Wednesday. I said, look at item number two.
Yeah. Everybody should give it a thought.
This is the one I use for glasses.
Oh, yeah.
It'll fill a room, like a big room.
What's it made?
Boss, B-O-S-E. I'm not never sure how you, whether you say Bose or Boss.
Bose.
Yeah, I think it's Bose.
Bose, I think it's probably Bosa because it's probably German.
Ah.
No, it's American. It's called Bose.
Okay, so it's Bose. Anyway, it does, it can get good and loud.
Well, you know the tricks to make things louder, especially bass. Put your speaker in a corner, either, you know, between a table and a wall or in a corner of your room, or if it has the more walls it has to bounce off of, the louder it is.
Cool, I didn't know that.
Yeah, one trick I used to love was you get these tiny little speakers. They're about the size of your fist, tiny little things. You put them on the desk, and you tell people, now just listen to the bass of this, the volume. You play it, and it comes out, and they're astounded. But what you didn't tell them about was the great big subwoofer that's underneath the table. Because you cannot tell where a subwoofer sound is coming from.
That's why you only need one subwoofer as opposed to stereo.
Yeah, a stereo subwoofer is kind of redundant. But they do make them.
Okay, Alan, I think you've got a couple of wrap-up slides.
I do indeed, yeah. So first up, the Ottawa Public Library presentations. I've got one tomorrow. Basically, it's a repeat of my Windows 10 Reaches End of Life presentation from last September. But if you're still running Windows 10 and you've got the extended support update program, you're enrolled for it, just remember that that runs out in October this year, so you're back to square one. We're going to talk about that and talk about Linux, of course. On Monday, April 27th, Chris is going to be talking about electronic mail at the Centennial Branch, 2 p.m. And on Thursday, the 30th, Linda's got organizing and showcasing photographs at Rosemount at 6 o'clock in the evening. Chris has reminded you a couple of times about Pizza Q, which will be our June meeting in Britannia Park. And if you want to go and expect to have pizza available, then you have to register by email to that address right there. And the details are on the website at that URL. So if you want to go to Pizza Q, pizza party, and don't forget to register. Before that, our May meeting, you remember we're going to have the Ask the Geek session. I've got multiple geeks lined up to answer all your questions. So the question is, what are your questions? So have them ready. And if you want to send them to me ahead of time, then that's fine. I'll be happy to receive them at my alan.german address. We don't want Chris getting a head start. I promise I won't look up the answers on Google or Perplexity AI. And I'm definitely not going to share your questions with anybody else. So send me some questions and then we'll have a list ready to go in May. And the last thing before that, next Wednesday, the 29th, will be our next Q&A session. So if you have questions that you need answered or you've got follow-up on the questions that we've asked tonight, you know, how to run 3D printers, for example, and you've got topics that you'd like to share, like DNS and disk backups and all kinds of things, just send us some brief details to suggestion box and we'll put you on the agenda. So I hope everybody enjoyed the presentations tonight. Lots of interesting topics, lots of interesting discussion, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. And you can make up a certificate for yourself. Say you were among the first 10,000 participants. our online Q&A sessions.